Want to know more about what your favorite ninjas have on their minds? Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast. It's available wherever you get your podcasts, and it's a great listen for any Ninja Warrior fan.
Hey everybody, welcome back to From Complex to Queens, Mason Avenue's Modern Week podcast. I am Steve Sipa, and this week I'm joined just by Ken Levin. So how are you doing this week, Ken?
Yeah, pretty good. Can't complain.
All right, so let's do promote, extend, and trade. And again, perusing Wikipedia, on this date in 1936, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was elected to his second term as president. And then if you fast forward to 1964, Lyndon Johnson was elected to his first – he was elected for his first term. But obviously because of JFK's assassination, he was already president. But I was doing a little research, and I couldn't actually find why those two guys are the only ones that we refer to using their three-letter initials. I was trying for like 10 minutes, you know, not really too in-depth. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that I could really piece together was that the Roosevelts and the Kennedys are like American nobility, I guess, quote unquote. And it was customary to use their middle names for, you know, official correspondences and such. And
you don't,
save
you don't
space.
Refer to William Howard Taft as WHT?
Right, exactly. I mean, Dwight D. Eisenhower will say the D, but we don't refer to him as DDE. Or George Bush is George W. Bush, but, you know, he's not GWB. That's the George Washington Bridge, not George Bush.
He should probably rebrand to that.
Yeah, it would be better. I mean, he's George W. Bush, so his branding is already terrible. I mean, any kind of rebranding would be better.
Yeah, naming yourself after one of the most trafficked bridges in...
It's still better than George Bush. I mean,
good career move.
Yeah. But anyway, so... In honor of those two presidents whose nicknames are their three initials, what baseball players that are also known more commonly by their three-letter initials are we going to promote, extend, or trade? First, we have JBJ, Jackie Bradley Jr. We have GMJ, Gary Matthews Jr. Mm-hmm. And we have EYJ, Eric Young Jr.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I think, as much as this pains me to say as a fellow Central New Jersey resident, I think we have to trade Eric Young Jr.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a particularly good reason for, promoting Gary Matthews Jr. other than I think he had at least one, like, very good season. Not for the Mets, but maybe I'm, misremembering Gary Matthews Jr.'s playing career. But I think the obvious extend, ironically enough, is Jackie Bradley Jr., who I know had like one, at least one 5-WAR season.
Yep.
I think. Yeah, Gary Matthews Jr. had one like all-star type campaign. So, yeah.
I also extended him. But I switched Gary Matthews Jr. and Eric Young Jr. mostly because I remember
Gary Matthews Jr. had a very bad Mets tenure.
Yes, like basically I have negative memories of him. And I remember he just seemed very insufferable. And his father, of course, too.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Eric Young, he wasn't good, but like... It was hard to dislike him.
If you had to guess Gary Matthews Jr.'s triple slash as a Met, what would you say it was?
Let's go with 192, 260, 340.
So you're almost there on both average and on base percentage, but you're a full 100 points high on the slugging.
Oh my god, I didn't know this was that bad.
Yeah, 190, 240, 190, 266, 241.
Oof.
Guess what the weight it is, the WRC+.
17?
38.
Oh, okay, well. Still yeah. Not good.
36.9% K rate, which is like 20 full points above his career norm.
But he did bat fourth for the Mets at least once, so
yes.
I'll figure. All right, well, that was a little disappointing, and that's a good segue, I guess, into the meat of our episode today, which are the St. Lucie Mets. And, you know, coming into the year, expectations were kind of tempered. The players that were projected to join St. Lucie at the beginning of the year weren't exactly too exciting of a group. And when the official rosters were announced, sure enough, you know, there really wasn't too much in terms of prospecting goodness. It was Desmond Lindsay, who he ranked 14 coming into the season. Tony DeBrell, who he ranked 15. And Jordan Humphreys, who he ranked 20. DeBrell, he had a fine year. We'll talk about him more in a minute. But Lindsay, he only played in 15 games, and he struggled thanks to all the injuries. And Humphreys ended up not even playing with St. Lucie. The rehab from Tommy John, there was complications beyond what we were told or expected, whatever. So, you know, prospect-wise, it was not good for St. Lucie. Their pitching on paper was pretty good. For the year, they had a 3.39 ERA, which is fourth best in the Florida State League. And among the starters that spent at least half their season there or so, Tommy Wilson paced the team. He had a 2.01 ERA. Tony DeBrell was next. He had a 2.39. When Joe Cavallaro was starting, he had a 3.02 ERA. Kevin Smith, he had a 3.05 ERA. Kyle Wilson, he had a 3.80. And Luke Rennie had a 3.83. Problem with all of that, though, is the numbers are nice, but by and large, there really is not too much talent in that group, or at least high upside talent anyway.
Yeah, a lot of them were kind of old for the level.
Yeah. DeBrell, his stuff's solid, but, you know, he has kind of major command issues, and he really struggled in Double-A, and he needs to figure things out if he's going to progress as a player. Smith, you know, the stuff isn't really that great. It's kind of loogie-ish, and he probably ends up as a lefty reliever. Joe Cavallaro and Tommy Wilson, they kind of have reliever profiles too, but I'm not really sure about their chances. And then Kyle Wilson, he's young, but the numbers aren't really that great, the peripherals. And Luke Rennie, he's, you know, older, so I'm not really sure about their chances either. So, yeah, great numbers from that group, but not really too sure about the odds that those players ultimately make it far in their minor league careers or, you know, become major leaguers.
Yeah, all of them are like a bit light on stuff.
Mm-hmm. Flaws, red flags for everybody. Of them, you know, DeBrell and Smith are the two marquee names, I guess, if you want to say. Call it like that. And I think that there's a lot of, not confusion, but I mean, let's hone in on Kevin Smith here, because that mm-hmm. is where there's a lot of dissonance, I guess it's a better way of putting it. Baseball America, they have him ranked in their top 10 Mets prospect list, and I think that that is fairly silly. It's not a great system by any means, the current, you know, Mets minor league system, but to have him in a top 10 list is, doesn't make sense to me. And MLB.com too, their prospect list also has Smith in the top 10, I believe, or just outside of it. And I haven't done my list yet, but just kind of the vague ideas that I have about where I would place people. Smith is not in my 10. I don't even know if he makes my 25.
Yeah. I think he'll be in my 25 just because I'm really going to be grasping for names at that point.
Yeah, I mean,
like, it's really not a good system.
Once you get past, even in the top 10.
Like, Zamora was in our top 25 last year, and I think he's not too different a prospect from Zamora, except that he's still a starter, you know? But I agree with you that he's, you know, kind of meh.
I mean, I don't know where Baseball America and MLB prospect pipeline got their reports from, but I mean, we've gotten firsthand reports of Smith too. And, you know, it's not bad, but, you know, like we're saying, it's probably ends up being a loogie profile, which, you know, as a Major League Baseball piece is a pretty valuable and important thing. Though going forward, I know the rules about rosters are changing and how many batters pitchers can face will be changing. So
there will always be a need, though, for a guy who's very one specific thing, you know.
But as their value, the value for a player like that as a Major League player is much greater than their value as, quote unquote, as a prospect, if that makes sense. That's how guys that, you know, like think of the Paul Sewalds or the Chasen Bradfords or the, who was the guy that went to the Rays? He was a left, Adam Kolarik.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like that, you know, don't really get any attention paid to them. And then they end up making the majors and have, you know, so-so careers, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah. You know what I think part of it is? He's a guy who there's a lot of hype around with spin rate.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, like, everybody cites it in their write-ups. And, you know, that's not necessarily an indicator that a guy will be good or that the pitch is actually good. It's just, like, one attribute of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that might be part of why Smith got so much helium this year.
And his fastball was about, just off the top of my head, 88 to 91. 92.
So, yeah, we give him the benefit of the doubt and say as a reliever it might be like 92, 93.
Yeah.
A
good slider. A good kind of frisbee-ish slider.
Mm-hmm.
Not much of a change or a secondary pitch. So, I mean, that is the...
That's a loogie.
Yep, that's a recipe for a lefty one-out guy. And it's just weird seeing his name, you know, ranked that high when
ranked above like the upside starters like Wolf, Santos, you know.
I mean, I could understand if you're a little hesitant about guys like that with upside. I am too. Like, I don't think that I'm going to have any of those guys in my top 10 because I am a little cautious when it comes to just overall distance of making it. You know, I think there's like an optimum age, but once you get to Brooklyn, Columbia or so, I feel like any kind of worries about, you know, if this guy's too far away, for me, that's like my line. And anything before that, it's just still a little too far. So, I mean, I could understand ranking a guy like him ahead of those guys that are much further out but have better stuff just because of, you know, proximity to the majors.
Yeah.
But even guys on the same exact team, a guy like Debrell. Now, I'm a guy that's always been very high on Debrell, but I don't see how you can look at numbers or stuff because they both have, you know, positives and they both have negatives and rank one extremely high, perhaps too high, and then not even really rank the other. It just seems like it's a very it's odd to me.
Yeah.
But hey. At least we're having a conversation, I guess, about this, about guys on the St. Lucie Mets pitching core. Because hitting was another story. As a whole, the team hit, what did they hit? 243, 320, 336. And believe it or not, that's actually an improvement from last year. So that just goes to show how in the pits St. Lucie's offense has been the last couple of years.
To be fair, it's a tough park to hit in.
It is, but.
But yeah, also not great luck.
Yeah. Quinn Brody, he spent about a third of the season there. He was their best hitter. In 53 games, he hit 285, 335, 435. Not amazing, you know, but for center fielder, that'll do. After him, Jeremy Vasquez hit 277, 359, 378. Good average, good on-base percentage, but as a first baseman, a 378 slugging percentage and five homers is not going to cut it. And then speaking of the power department, we got a team leading 11 homers out of Carlos Cortez, and his batting line was 255, 336, 397 overall. You could kind of make the case that Brody might get himself a major league playing time in a year or two as like a fourth, fifth starter, you know, Kevin Kaczmarski-ish kind of guy that maybe gets a handful of at-bats or whatever and is kind of shuttled up and down. But you really have to squint to see any kind of future for, like, any of St. Lucie's hitters.
I assume Carlos Cortez will make the big leagues just because they have something into him, you know?
It's just
an investment into him.
Last season, after he was drafted, he didn't perform particularly great in Brooklyn. And you could chalk it up to, obviously, A, it's Brooklyn, and B, coming off of a year at college.
Yeah, and a deep, like, College World Series run.
Yeah, so, okay, you can give that an asterisk. But this year, you know, again, like, the hitting, we know that he's not that great of a hitter. The power, you know, he kind of changed his approach and mechanics and everything while he was in school to kind of have more power. And 11 homers, like, it's better than it was last year, but it's still not particularly great.
It's basically all he contributes, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there were very few doubles, very few triples. It was just all homers, which is why his slugging percentage was below 400. It's just a year and some months removed from that pick. It's still is puzzling.
He's got a cup of coffee in him.
Yeah.
At least one.
I mean,
I don't know if he'll be any good, but I think guys who get a $1 million signing bonus get a shot at some point.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to be pushed along. I don't think that he has anything left to prove in St. Lucie. It wasn't a great season, but it wasn't like catastrophically terrible that you have to hold him back again. So he'll start next year in Binghamton. And he seems like a guy that'll probably benefit from the juice ball in AAA. I could see him having like a Dilson Herrera-esque season if he ever makes
it. I was going to say, he reminds me of Dilson Herrera a bit in terms of like positional fit, body, but without like the athleticism that made Herrera like very interesting.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I mean, with Cortez, the thing that everybody, you know, kind of hones in on is the positional versatility because he was a switch hitter and a switch fielder and therefore could play like anywhere. And like the problem with that is, you know, it's all fine and dandy if you could play left field in theory, but you know, he's not good at it.
Yeah. I'm like, you know, just throw a guy in as throw a guy in left field just to get his bat in the lineup. That's as big a part of my philosophy as anything, but like there are limits.
Yeah, so
you know,
he is kind of he might have the theoretical versatility to play other positions, but I mean he's kind of stuck at second.
It's really just second and maybe left field.
Yeah, that makes the Dilson comparisons that much stronger.
Yeah,
and my birds are like going crazy in the background, so they must really hate Carlos Cortez.
Oh no!
Yeah, wow. But yeah, like just all in all, it was just not a good year for St. Lucie. And I really can't think of a single game or a single week or a single period, whatever, that St. Lucie is actually good or even, like, exciting.
I wouldn't say exciting, but they were, like, pretty good deep into the season. They were just out of the races because, you know, Wander Franco was playing for Clearwater. Or not Clearwater. Tampa?
I forget
who the Rays affiliate is.
I don't know.
I don't know. They ended up winning the title when the season, you know, was abruptly ended.
The Threshers, I believe, won.
Yeah.
Either Threshers or Dunedain. Either or.
Yeah, whatever.
Well, actually, we're going to talk about them in a little bit after the break, but whoever it was. But I don't know. Like, I think the most noteworthy thing about St. Lucie's season was that on July 4th, the stadium lit on fire.
What an image.
And when your season is literally like a dumpster fire and you have a dumpster fire, that's, it just doesn't look good. Not a good look for them. You know, that happened in June. They had a 12 game losing streak. August. Anytime you have a losing streak like that, it's, you know, not good. A couple of games. Okay. That's not good. You get swept. You know, maybe even you lose two series in a row, you get swept twice. That's like pitiful, but 12 games, that's like.
That's a lot. And,
yeah.
That's like almost 2 weeks of losing.
Yep. And then really the only thing that stopped that losing streak was then the season was ended, in preparation for Hurricane Dorian, which thankfully never, you know, made landfall here. Well, really here anyway, destructive landfall. So like that was the only thing that kind of put an end, a merciful end to their season, I guess. Cause that would have probably been either three or four more losses at the rate that they were going. And one thing that they did not need was more losses. All right. Well, let's take a break here. Enough about the bad things about the St. Lucie Mets. When we get back, we'll talk a little bit about St. Lucie as a whole.
Check out the American Ninja Warrior podcast for a behind-the-scenes look at all the action of the show and more with your favorite competitors. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk, and we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means, and basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Seipa. I'm joined this week by Ken Levin. And Ken, you spent some time down in St. Lucie this year, huh?
Yeah, I went for just a day in spring training in March.
All right, so first and most importantly, do you have any Florida Man stories? Because I was looking into some of the Florida Man archives, I guess, and there are a couple of good ones that took place in St. Lucie. Probably the best the best one is Wet Willie Attack puts Florida Man in jail.
That's pretty good.
There's Port St. Lucie Man gets DUI on lawnmower. Florida Man throws whiskey bottle bomb at chickens.
Oh, wow.
I'm not really sure how that works, but. That seems a little extreme. Florida woman tells cops that the wind blew cocaine into her purse. Which, you know, could happen, so whatever. Similar to that, there's Florida man with pockets full of drugs, says pants were borrowed. And then I think this one was my favorite of all of them. Florida woman covered in chicken wing sauce and blue cheese gets arrested for assaulting her boyfriend. So, did you have any negative encounters with stereotypical Florida men? And
I would say no, not necessarily, although driving up there was an experience. People, especially, you know, that's not really northern Florida, but it's northbound, I guess. people drive like they have a death wish. It's wild.
Was it on... I-95 or off of
I-95? I think so.
Yeah,
I don't remember, but...
I drove down to Florida. I mean, I didn't drive. I was the passenger when I was, like, 14, you know, 13, 14, whatever. Like, we went to Orlando and Disneyland or World, whichever one. So I don't really have too many memories of the driving part of it, except for just, you know, it being long.
Yeah. Well, we only drove up from Miami because we were on vacation in Miami. So we rented a car and drove up to the complex for a day. Mm. But yeah, people drive like there's no tomorrow. Like they're driving away from imminent danger.
And you're a New Jersey native, born and raised and everything, and I feel like New Jersey has bad drivers.
So I would argue that New Jersey does have bad drivers, but it's for completely different reasons. It's because, like, everybody needs to be somewhere all the time in New Jersey.
I can agree with that.
It's like a state full of, like, aggressive businessmen.
I can agree that, I mean, I live on Staten Island, which is also known for just fair share of bad drivers. And I can agree with that characterization that it's full of bad drivers if you are a passive driver. If you're an equally aggressive driver that you're going somewhere, then, you know, everything is fine, which I find.
No, I agree with that. Florida's just, you know, whatever is behind you in the rearview mirror is terrifying and you want to outrun it as quickly as possible.
I felt that way when I was driving down from Harpers Ferry to Kingsport and Pulaski over the summer, because it was an interstate route. I think it was I-85, but it literally is going through Appalachia, and you have like giant 18-wheeler trucks that are doing like 70 on these not exactly hairpin turns, but I mean, you know, on a highway somewhere I'm not familiar with.
Yeah.
Literally in the mountains. Yeah, it could be a little.
Yeah, trying to make those deadlines.
Yeah, it can be a little nervous when you're looking back and you see this truck like coming on you really fast. So yeah, kind of wild. St. Lucie was basically like all farmland and swamp and empty like 50 years ago. In the 1970 census, the population was 300. In 1980, 10 years later, the population is 14,690, which is an increase of 4,351.5%. And today it has an estimated population of about 195,000 people. So it's a pretty, you know, solid small town, small city, whatever you want to call it. And there's stuff to do from what I gather, but like, spring training baseball and then the GCL and the St. Lucie Mets, they're like the biggest thing in town. So does the city kind of embrace like baseball as a whole?
Yeah. There? I think having like a big league team having like their home base there is like a pretty big point of pride. Like not too dissimilar for, I guess, for them as having a big league team, you know, in your town, you know? Like, I went to, we were running a little bit late, but, you know, I always need coffee, so we stopped at the Starbucks on the, that's maybe right across, a couple blocks away from the complex. And, like, four different people while I was in line, like, wearing all my Mets crap, asked me, like, oh, you're a Mets fan? Yeah, no, that's awesome, you know. Tons of you guys are coming through this time of the year, you know. So I can't say for certain, not having spent a lot of time there, but it seems like it is kind of like the center of town in a lot of ways. Definitely like a big employer, just given how big the complex is. I wouldn't be surprised if during spring training the city swells to like three times its usual size. Mm.
I've never been there myself, and honestly, I don't really have too much of an interest in going. I know it sounds kind of weird, but I'm terrified of flying, so that's like a major problem right there. And I would have to drive all the way down to Florida, which I'm not really too interested in doing because, you know, that's a hike.
Yeah, you'd have to plan it as part of like a 2-week trip or something.
Yeah, and I'm really the only driver in my small group of people that I do you know, minor league baseball things with. So I'm not taking on a 25-hour trip, whatever it is.
Right.
But what is, you know, what's it like, the complex and First Data Field and just, you know, the Mets facility as a whole? Like, what's it like to just kind of go there and just like, oh, here's a field, and okay, here's field B and field C and D, and there's just all over the place.
It's like, I have a short attention span, so it's great to have four baseball fields, each with exhibition games going at the same time, you know? Like, literally, the day that I went was DeGrom was throwing a sim game against Syndergaard. And it was literally like I'd bounce from one field and, oh, Ronnie Mauricio is, you know, facing Jacob DeGrom right now. And then on the field behind me, Francisco Alvarez is catching Junior Santos, and just kind of bouncing between those two is just awesome. Like, highly recommend it.
Yeah, it's like sensory baseball overload.
Yeah, it's like what I do at home with, you know, MLB.TV, but like – in real time, just turning your head with guys you'd never get to see. yeah, and like the facilities are very nice. The fields are kind of simple on the backfields, at least. It's like, you know, probably not too dissimilar from, you know, a park field,
mm-hmm.
well-maintained park field. You know, dugouts with chain link fences and stuff. But in the center, there's like a big sort of office. And yeah, it was just cool to walk. There's just a bunch of people, you know, from ranging from pretty much everybody who works for the team to just random, you know, Jamokes like me. Yeah, I don't know.
Did you encounter any alligators?
I did not, no.
Okay, good.
Supposedly there were snakes on the backfields, either the day we were there or, you know, in the recent past, because like four people mentioned it, but like, you know, I didn't see any firsthand evidence of that.
All right, good. I was looking at attendance in the Florida State League, and it's actually really weird. Dunedin, they're the Blue Jay affiliate. They drew 11,757 fans all of last year, which is all at the bottom. And then the Clearwater Threshers, they were at the top. They drew 180,069. And the two teams are literally like 10 to 15 minutes from each other. Dunedin was playing at a temporary home this year since they're building a new stadium, but them being at the bottom goes back, you know, a couple of years. And obviously it's near Tampa and their major league club and everything. But as somebody from the north here, where we have, you know, less mild weather during the spring, you know, we could have freaking blizzards in April. Do you have anything to say to the people of, you know, some of those smaller drawing Florida teams that just don't take advantage of the really nice weather that they have?
I mean, if I lived, you know, down there with multiple big league complexes around, I'd probably be at a complex pretty much every day. at some point, you know, I think that's really cool. Like, getting to see the earliest wave.
Obviously, I guess we're not the best people to kind of profile, since we are the definition of,
you know, we're total dorks.
Niche fanatics, whatever, but.
Yeah. But yeah, I'd be around a lot.
Yeah. The Staten Island Yankees are like 15 minutes from me, and whenever the Cyclones are playing, like, I'm always there, and I don't go to every single Cyclones game because it's in Brooklyn, which is a kind of pain in the ass to get to, either taking, you know, the ferry and the train and everything, or driving and having to pay freaking $20 toll, which adds up pretty quickly, But I mean, if that wasn't the case, I think I would have one of those, you know, 40 or possibly even full season kind of ticket plan for the Cyclones and Trenton, and whenever Trenton Thunder are playing Binghamton down there at Arm & Hammer Stadium, I'm go to majority of those games, which unfortunately is usually only one series. And same thing with Lakewood when they play the Columbia Fireflies, you know, I'm there. And then unfortunately they didn't play them this year, so I had to go down there, which is was fun, but the pain.
Yeah, like, not as easy.
Yeah.
They are coming up twice in this upcoming
year. Yes, right? I know. I'm happy for that. My car is not happy for that, but I am. But yeah, like if there was literally baseball north, south, west, and east of me as a Florida resident, I'd be going to games constantly.
I will say that there's probably a lot of competition for, you know, non sort of like industry, like the general population to come to games.
Yeah, I mean,
just given there's so many of them all clustered in an area.
Yeah, you have a couple of teams.
Logistical purposes, but also, you know, make some things kind of hard.
You have the couple teams on the Atlantic coast, then you have a couple of teams on the Gulf of Mexico side. And then on top of that, then, right, there's like the FSL teams. And then there's the GCL teams, so there is quite a bit going on. But to me, that would just mean great baseball every night.
Yeah,
you could vary it up a bit. But yeah, it's kind of crazy, just all of the stuff going on down there that you don't really realize, and how clustered everything is. Because Florida is, you know, I don't know off the top of my head the length of it, but it's not very wide. I mean, if you're kind of in one, if you're on one side of the state, you can drive to the other side widthwise in about an hour and a half or so.
Yeah, it's something like 2 hours or something.
Yeah,
like
so, I mean, it's, you know, I would be all over the place, but I guess it's a good thing that I'm not down there. Any other stray random observations about St. Lucie that you made while you were down there, and or the St. Lucie complex, first out of field, all of that?
Not really. The ballpark is really nice. There's a lot of different areas to just chill, which is cool. I like in the outfield, they have like a little grass area you can just kind of lay out on. Yeah, would highly recommend it as a trip.
All right. Well, if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you could go ahead and send us an email at our email address from complexthequeens@gmail.com. You can follow us all on Twitter. I am at Steve Sipa, and Ken is at Ken1191. Subscribe to the podcast if you don't. Rate and review it if you haven't already. And obviously, thank you for listening. And we'll be back next week with a recap of the Binghamton Rumble Ponies and their 2019 season. And until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.